Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now the Guardian's diplomatic correspondent, Julian Borger. We'll talk about some current issues and his new book, The Butcher's Trail, How the Search for Balkan War Criminals Became the World's Most Successful Manhunt. Julian, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on.
Let me get you on some current issues first, and then we'll get into the book. Can diplomacy work to fight ISIS? Secretary Kerry and others seem to be trying. Is there a diplomatic path?
Potentially, but for diplomacy, you need partners. You need the Russians and the Iranians to be interested in having a deal. And at the moment, they're not, because they see the potential of a military solution, a military victory.
You mean on the part of Assad?
On the part of Assad, absolutely, yes. They're destroying the opposition groups in Aleppo, and now Assad is feeling comfortable. So there is less prospect now than there has been for any time for several years of a diplomatic solution.
But Assad is fighting ISIS, among other rebel groups, so why wouldn't that be bad for ISIS?
He's not really fighting ISIS with any great enthusiasm, nor are the Russians. They are working towards a position where it's just the regime and ISIS, and then we'll try and force the West to choose and say it's just between the Assad regime and ISIS, because they will have got rid of everyone else.
So do you think ISIS can coexist with Assad if Assad, in fact, does prevail, at least for the medium term?
I can imagine there being a modus vivendi that Assad will control his heartland in the West, and ISIS will have free reign in the East. I can imagine that happening.
Which means they're really not about being a Syrian rebel group. They're about setting up their caliphate wherever they can set it up and do their international terrorism and other things, right?
Absolutely. They're looking for an area of land, of territory, from which to organize and expand.
How about regarding the Syrian refugees? Does international diplomacy play a role, or is this country by country, like the debate we're having here?
Well, ideally, the European Union could have negotiated with Turkey about the flow of refugees. It is a manageable crisis in terms of the numbers, but it hasn't been managed. It hasn't been managed at all well by the EU, by Turkey, or by the individual states. Now it's really a question of Germany and Sweden trying to cut a separate deal with the Turks, but so far it's not come off.
Diplomacy itself is taking a hit as kind of weak in the Republican presidential race in general, and from Trump and Cruz, and Rubio is very tough on this too. Do you think it's having any impact on world affairs and on the state of diplomacy to solve any problems right now? Or is it just blah, 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 unless one of them is actually elected?
No, absolutely not. And exhibit A is the nuclear deal with Iran. As a result of that long negotiated deal, the Iranians have ripped out huge numbers, thousands of centrifuges, have taken out the reactor of their heavy water, the core of their heavy water reactor in Arak. You couldn't have done that with weeks of bombing. And that was one case in which with diplomacy showed itself far more effective in terms of reducing the threat that Iran poses than any amount of plausible military action.
But that was negotiated by the Obama administration before this campaign really started. I'm just curious if you think, from your perch in London and looking at the world in general, whether all this diplomacy bashing is having any deleterious effect on anything, or not really, unless one of them gets elected.
Yes. I mean, you would expect them to do this because the Obama administration has been very much about trying to get multilateral diplomacy to work. So you'd expect in the Republican camp for that to be bashed. But I would bet that most of those Republican candidates, if they were in office, would have done a similar deal with Iran.
And if they get the actual responsibility on their shoulders, they'll be instant diplomats. Julian Borger, my guest, diplomatic correspondent for The Guardian and author of the new book, The Butcher's Trail, How the Search for Balkan War Criminals Became the World's Most Successful Manhunt. This is the perpetrators for people who weren't paying attention to the news yet or forgot, perpetrators of genocide during the Yugoslav wars in the 1990s. Do you want to remind us what ethnic cleansing occurred there, the extent of it?
Absolutely. A total of about 130,000 people were killed as part of these wars that followed on the collapse of Yugoslavia, in which primarily the Serbs, but also the Croats, tried to carve out a greater Serbia and a greater Croatia at the expense of this multinational republic, Bosnia. And to do so, they were prepared to use the means of terror, killing large numbers of civilians to try and drive the others out. In particular, Bosnian Muslims, known as Bosniaks, were the main victims. With the aim of having a neat ethnic map in a country that was a hodgepodge, a kind of Jackson Pollock of ethnic communities, and it was incredibly bloody and the worst killing that Europe has seen since the Nazi era.
So the world's most successful manhunt, who were they actually hunting for?
They were hunting for people who had been indicted by the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, a total of 160 men, one woman, indicted for war crimes, crimes against humanity. They came from Croatia, they came from Bosnia, they came from Serbia, Montenegro, and Kosovo, the old Yugoslav republics.
161 people is a lot of people. Centrally controlled, taking orders from the top down, or doing this on their own because passions were so inflamed?
A mix, but the driving force was from the top down, coming from Belgrade, to a certain extent from Zagreb, because of these territorial aims and these desires to create a greater Serbia, a greater Croatia.
And so eventually a successful manhunt, but you write that the initial plans for large-scale joint arrest operations by the five Allied armies were brought crashing down by a single 28-year-old French officer. Who was that officer?
His name was Hervé Gourmelon, and he was based in Sarajevo for the French. And they had this big operation planned out of Stuttgart, where European Special Forces headquarters were. And they were going to have this massive sweep, and the cornerstone of it would be a Franco-American operation to get the top war criminals in an area where the French were operating. And this guy, Gourmelon, his job was to go up and down between Sarajevo and the Bosnian Serb headquarters in Pale, trying to get information. But the CIA began to suspect that he was giving away more information than he was collecting. They denounced him as a spy, and he was brought back to Paris. But the French sent him back, kind of shrugged their shoulders. And in the end, the CIA came to the conclusion that he was doing a very French form of force protection, telling the bad guys, we're going to be coming into your town. We don't want any trouble. We don't want any exchange of fire. Just keep your heads down. And the impact was really to sour Franco-American military relations for years. And after that, each country went about its own manhunt pretty much separately.
And you give the Pentagon, the U.S. military, a fair amount of credit. Their eventual involvement transformed the manhunt?
It was transformative in that they're a bigger organization. They picked up a lot of the people responsible for the Srebrenica killings. But at first, they were almost completely ineffective because they wanted to do things in a very large-scale way. That was the Pentagon mindset back then. They wanted no casualties, and they wanted to do things big. And so what happened is they were going to have an operation to pick up five of the war criminals in an American zone. But back then, before 9/11, this was the only show in town if you were in the special forces. So everyone flew in from Tampa. You had five colonels, a general, lots of troops. And of course, the Bosnian Serbs saw this happening, and they all went to ground.
You write about one of these suspected war criminals who is connected to the Gambino crime family, and John Gotti, here in New York.
That's right. He was hidden by with the help of a sub mafioso who was linked to Gotti, who put him in a mountain resort where he had a casino, and this was inside Serbia. The Americans, as part of the NATO force in Bosnia, didn't have jurisdiction, but they did send special forces over. They found him, but the American military lawyers said, you can look, but you can't touch. You can find where he is, but you can't do the arrest. So they hired some Serb mercenaries to go knock him out with a baseball bat, tie him up, put him in the back of an old red Mercedes. They floated that back into Bosnia and gave the Americans a call and said, your packaged ham, which was the code word, is waiting for you. And so the Americans were able to perform this arrest inside Bosnia.
How many of the 161 were eventually apprehended?
Well, all of them faced justice. They were able to tick off every single name on their list, which was remarkable for a UN mission that actually completed it itself. About 65 of those were under the official record, captured and arrested. But a lot of the others were also captured, but because of face saving, they were called voluntary surrenders. So about 80 of them, I estimate, were captured, and then a lot more handed themselves in rather than stay up at night wondering when American special forces were going to come for them.
At one point, you write, the road that began with the best of motives in the Balkans ended up in Guantanamo Bay. How so?
Because they did the first renditions from Bosnia. They were at the midst of this manhunt when 9/11 happened, and immediately the special forces who were tasked to do this were redirected to Afghanistan, eventually to Iraq. And a lot of the techniques, one of the former special forces guys told to me, everything that we did in Afghanistan and Iraq in terms of tracking down terrorists, we learned how to do that in Bosnia, all the techniques.
Meaning the dark stuff. When you talk about rendition, we use that during the Iraq and Afghanistan war, as you know, to mean taking suspects and putting them in so-called black sites that are not under the usual military justice system or national criminal justice system without those standards, so they could be tortured at worst or very aggressively interrogated in various ways. That happened in some of these cases?
Well, what happened was in the Bosnian manhunt, the techniques were taken from that manhunt to the war on terror. What wasn't taken along was the legal underpinning. There was a UN Security Council resolutions underscoring, underpinning the manhunt and the arrests and the rendition of the suspects to the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. When it segued to the war on terror, and it did so inside Bosnia, the first renditions were was a Jordanian and an Egyptian inside Bosnia, all that legal underpinning evaporated. It wasn't there, but the techniques that were used were the same.
You wrote that only one of the 161 names on the Hague Tribunal's wanted list of indictees was female. You mentioned that before, too. On the other hand, you write, the two people who did more than any other individuals to ensure the suspects were all tracked down happened to be women. Who are they?
That's right. They were the four chief prosecutors at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. The second and the third, and arguably the most effective, were women. First was Louise Arbour, a Canadian judge, and the second was Carla Del Ponte, a Swiss-Italian prosecutor. And they were very effective at hammering on the doors of Western capitals and making them pay attention, because there wasn't a great deal of enthusiasm for doing this. And they really held them to account and were some of the most effective people in terms of making sure that this manhunt and this UN mission was carried through to completion.
Do you think the war crimes tribunals that took place set a precedent that's meaningful as a deterrence to dictators and others around the world from committing war crimes in the future?
I think it did, and I think a lot of the achievement of making sure these people were tracked down and facing justice has since unraveled, because the successor body is the International Criminal Court, and the great powers, the US, Russia, China, India, haven't wanted to have anything to do with it. And so it has been a weak court. And that means that the impunity for mass crimes that this manhunt did something to push back, that impunity is back, and at a very heavy price, because all the focus now is on terrorism. But in so many ways, the terrorist threat that we face today has grown out of situations where there have been mass atrocities against civilians.
We're almost out of time. Why did you want to revisit the more than 20-year-old Serbian and Bosnian and, you know, former Yugoslav states atrocities that happened so long ago now for a book?
Well, the last arrest, when the last name to be crossed off the list was only in 2011, and so that's when I started working on it. I worked originally on a magazine, but I realized there were so many stories. This was such a vast, sprawling manhunt that it was a story worth telling.
And you wrote that the war criminals are walking free again. Nationalism is on the rise. Could the Balkans explode again?
I think that it is destined to fester and decay. I don't think they will explode into the kind of warfare that we saw in the 90s. But what is a risk is, in Bosnia and Kosovo, these are both Islamic countries. They both have been terribly neglected, badly treated. And the long-term threat of jihadism inside Europe from those sources is very serious indeed.
Julian Borger, diplomatic correspondent for The Guardian, and now the author of The Butcher's Trail, How the Search for Balkan War Criminals Became the World's Most Successful Manhunt. And he'll be doing some appearances here in New York tomorrow at noon at the Columbia University Harriman Institute on the Columbia campus, and on Wednesday at 1 o'clock in conversation with David Rode at the UN Bookshop. So tomorrow at noon at the Shulman Seminar Room, International Affairs Building on the Columbia campus, and 1 o'clock Wednesday at the UN Bookshop, 1st Avenue and 46th Street. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up next. On this Chinese New Year, happy Year of the Monkey, by the way, we will meet the Chinese Consul General to New York, Ambassador Zhang Zhang. Stay with us.